picture an elite law firm, what comes to mind? Custom suits and silk ties, 80-hour work weeks, Christmas parties at the country club. When you think about that theoretical conference room full of senior partners, odds are the picture in your head is mostly white, and research backs that up. As of 2021, the partnerships at several top firms in the country hovered around 2% black. The same is true in investment banking. Just 3% of executives at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley in 2021 were black. But racial bias isn't necessarily what's at play here. A new study explains that alienation, isolation, and frustration, workplace issues that can be difficult to describe and quantify, are burdening black professionals and blocking them from advancement. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Law professor and sociologist Kevin Woodson interviewed more than 100 black corporate attorneys, consultants, and investment bankers about their experiences at these so-called high-status jobs. His new book is called The Black Ceiling: How Race Still Matters in the Elite Workspace, and he joins us now to talk about it. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about what you learned from your research, will you share a little bit more about the study? Tell me how you found people to interview and why you chose kind of a life history style approach to talking with them.
Sure. So this is a topic that's been of interest for me for a very long time, going back to many moons ago when I worked as an attorney at a very prestigious large law firm in Washington, D.C. And in my time working as a professional, I developed a network of people and gained some insights from their experiences and perspectives. And so I started this project as a seminar paper in grad school. And I reached out to some contacts of mine and asked them to spread the word about this study, where I wanted to figure out how exactly race was affecting individual professionals' careers at these firms, and why some people had such different experiences than others. Mm-hmm. And so to do this, I reached out to them, sent them kind of a brief snippet explaining what I would be asking them about, and we took it from there. So there were a lot of people who were very interested in sharing their experiences and in helping to provide information that could be useful for other people. And so the life history focus was just sort of based on my intuition that different professionals' prior life experiences had a lot to do with how they did at their firm jobs. And to do that, I started each interview from day one. So I asked people about where they were born, where they grew up, what their experiences were like racially. And I ended up getting this really rich collection of data that just basically provided their life histories. And that gave me a lot of information to process and digest. And it really helped me come up with certain insights that I hadn't been seeing in the previous studies.
Let's talk a little bit about previous research. The burdens of Black professionals, that's been a topic that has been researched in the past, but it's been mostly done through the lens of racial bias, right?
Yes, that's correct. And I don't mean to denigrate that work. I think it's very important that we focus on the potential role of racial bias. But I think that bias is just one of several problems and challenges that can undermine the careers of Black professionals in these firms.
So you use the phrase racial discomfort in this book. Can you explain that and also kind of why it's distinct from overt discrimination?
Sure. So the interesting thing is that racial discomfort, that's a term that I use that refers to the general unease that many Black professionals experience when they're working at these predominantly white work settings. And the interesting thing about it is that it can affect people in conjunction with racial bias, but it can also undermine people's careers in the absence of racial bias. So in this book, I focus on two particular types of racial discomfort. There's stigma anxiety, and that's the discomfort that people experience due to their concerns about possibly being discriminated against in the future. And there's also social alienation, and that's the unease that comes when you feel isolated and marginalized because your interests, your social background is very different than those of your colleagues. And both of these types of problems can present really subtle but powerful disadvantages for Black professionals, even if nobody is actually actively discriminating against them.
So I want to really get into both social alienation and stigma anxiety a little bit later in the conversation. But before we do that, I think it's important to kind of build this foundation of understanding why investment banks and, you know, major consulting firms and elite law firms are such white spaces. And this goes far beyond just demographics, correct?
Oh, absolutely. So these firms in the book I explain are white in a number of ways that are easily taken for granted, but not so much by the Black professionals who work there. So, of course, demographically, they're very white. As you mentioned in the introduction, there are a really severe underrepresentation of Black professionals in the senior management ranks of these firms. But even the overall demographics, they're predominantly white. And they're also symbolically white, to the extent that if you walk into these firms and you're, if you were to just walk down the offices of one of these fancy white shoe law firms, you would see the names and you would see the images of a lot of old white men. And that's because of the history of these firms. These firms are, in many instances, decades and decades old. And they were founded in an era where, when it was acceptable for them not to hire Black professionals. And for many years, many of these firms didn't hire any Black professionals, let alone Black partners and senior leaders. And that still is reflected in some of these subtle ways when you are actually at in these firms. And culturally, I think this is easy to overlook, but very important on a day-to-day basis. These firms are culturally white spaces to the extent that because they're predominantly white demographically, the things that people are interested in, the things that people talk about, the places where happy hour events and social outings occur, these tend to take place according to the preferences of the firm's white professionals. And in many subtle ways, this can be a problem for many Black professionals because they might have very different interests and tastes.
Can you give a couple examples? You do a wonderful job in the book of really making all of this kind of white cultural overlay so vivid. Give a couple examples of kind of white cultural character that these law firms and big investment banks embody.
Sure. So I think there are a number of interesting examples. Some of them relate to things as mundane as TV show preferences or sporting choices. So there's one story I like to tell about one Black attorney who worked at a firm where the partners in her group were really into football and hunting. And she just had no interest or knowledge base concerning these activities. And if you look at the demographics for hunting in particular, you'll see that there's a really a big racial skew in who partakes in hunting and hunting culture. And in this way, some of her white colleagues were better able to bond over their shared interest in or participation in hunting while she was on the outside looking in. But also there are many stories that come up in the course of my interviews where people talk about being frustrated that their white colleagues want to talk about Friends and Seinfeld all day, or even reminiscing about their college activities, playing beer pong. There are just these little differences that for some people can be a little frustrating, or it also can lead to work groups deciding to hold their after hours outings at certain Irish dive bars that they love and that some of the Black professionals find very unfamiliar and uncomfortable.
And you make the point, too, that there's only really two ways to go. If you find yourself in a place where you have nothing in common with your colleagues and the activities they do are awkward and uninteresting to you, you have only two choices, really. You can either adapt and put a lot of pressure on yourself and fake it and make yourself uncomfortable, or you can withdraw. And neither one of those things are very good for someone's professional advancement. Can you kind of link those two ideas? So it sounds silly, but if you didn't watch Seinfeld and if you don't like, you know, Irish pub after hours, happy hours, I mean, how can just those kind of fundamental differences make your professional life more burdensome?
Yeah, so I should step back and explain. Another thing to note about these types of work environments in particular is that relationships with your colleagues are just incredibly important. So your relationships determine your access to certain types of high quality opportunities and assignments. They determined who's going to bat for you when it comes time to make promotions decisions or to allocate bonuses. And it also shapes who gets access to the kind of informal advice and guidance that can make all the difference in determining whether you're able to handle your work well and to perform well in your assignments. And so this is incredibly important because this is a means by which people bond and form rapport and relationships with one another. And so there's a pressure to go to these events and these gatherings, even though on the outside looking in, they might seem as if they should have nothing to do with someone's professional career. Those types of relationships can really be important. And so there's this pressure to go along and to attend. But once you make that decision and you attend, it can be highly uncomfortable if you're there and you feel that you can't really contribute to the conversations, or you feel that you're being made to feel like more of an outsider. And that can kind of set a chain reaction in place where you end up feeling more and more convinced that you're just not like these other people and you don't belong.
I
And
think,
so,
oh, sorry, I was going to say that that really goes to your point that cultural homophily is a thing, right? We all kind of gravitate towards people we feel that we are like, and that really affects people in these extremely white spaces who aren't white.
yes, and that's something that can happen again with or without racial bias. So cultural homophily is the tendency to gravitate toward other people who share similar cultural interests and background experiences. And so, in other words, the more that we have in common with other people, the more likely we are to befriend them, to spend time with them. And that can have a very powerful effect at these firms where people want to be comfortable and they want to find people they can trust and bond with. And that homophily process really helps people who share the right traits, but it can really disadvantage those who are outsiders.
And as even if we pretend that our like kind of performance review systems are very objective and, you know, are measurable, at the end of the day, there is always going to be subjectivity with how someone's work is evaluated. And I'm guessing social interactions and mentorship and bonds really factor in to how people are viewed overall as a competent employee.
Yes, so in the course of my interviews, a number of people mentioned that what they thought was most important, the more important than race or gender or anything else, is having a relationship with a high-powered senior colleague who's going to go to bat for you and give you the benefit of the doubt and do things to make sure that they're spreading a good word about you to their colleagues and to their clients. And there's a huge subjective component to all of that, in the sense that they have to decide whether they think you're performing at a very high level and whether they think your performance speaks highly of your future potential. And bias can obviously skew how people make those assessments, but even putting bias aside, we tend to make those assessments more charitably when we're dealing with somebody who we know and who we really like as a person.
So, Kevin, I want to go into this one part of our conversation we touched on in the last segment a little deeper, which is the idea that what kind of work you were given. And I don't think people maybe who aren't familiar with kind of these elite law firms may not realize how different the work you're given can be. You can get an assignment as a first-year associate that's incredibly valuable, that is worth a ton of billable hours, that will endear you to influential partners and is interesting and engaging, or you can get an assignment that is just drudgery, that is a one-off, that isn't worth very much billable time. You might even have to use non-billable time to complete it. And they become two very different working experiences that have super different implications for how you're viewed. Can you explain that a little bit more and how that can really work in the favor of white people who have bonded with colleagues and work against black people who maybe haven't been as connected?
Sure, I should say that I thought you explained the distinction very well
Oh,
just
thanks.
now.
Well, there's a lot of lawyers in my family, so speaking from a bit of experience.
Well, there is this incredibly important distinction between developmental work and what you might consider grudge work or paperwork. And so the developmental work allows people to develop what I refer to as career capital. And career capital essentially encompasses a number of the different rewards that you get when you're on the right path and you're advancing in your career. This includes financial capital. If it brings you more hours of work, you might be eligible for more bigger bonuses. It also brings social capital because it helps you build relationships with the right senior colleagues and the right clients. It also helps you achieve human capital to the extent that it's actually providing you valuable skills that can help you in your career. And it also helps with your reputation, your reputational capital. And so it's incredibly important as a junior professional that you get as much of this work as possible. And as you mentioned, a lot of the work doesn't have those characteristics. A lot of the work that people receive is just really work that's profitable for the firm, but does nothing to provide them any of those forms of capital. So it can be work that's really of an administrative or clerical nature. And so people who have the best relationships with their colleagues are going to have preferential access to this work. So if you're tight with the partners in your group, they're going to think of you when they have a new opportunity that they think might be beneficial to a junior colleague's career. And these subtle decisions can really make a big difference cumulatively. So it's not a big deal if one person gets a premium assignment one day and the next person gets it the next day. But if you are consistently getting more of these premium assignments than everyone else, you're going to have a really big advantage over your peers.
And I was going to say, just the gap just continues to widen, right? Because the more work you do well of this variety, you're going to get thought of again and again. And pretty soon you kind of distinguish yourself. And it's really difficult for people who find themselves behind the curve to try to catch up. And that has major implications for even the money they earn.
Oh, right. So it can be incredibly difficult to catch up because when you receive those premium assignments and you do a good job on them, you've actually become more qualified than your peers for future assignments. So at that point, it becomes rational for a senior professional to say, I want this person on my case. And somebody has to really go out of their way to make sure that other people are getting the opportunities to catch up. And it can be very difficult. And it sends a signal to some people when they realize that they're falling behind. I talk about this in the book. There are people who leave these firms voluntarily to try to get a fresh start somewhere else where they think they'll have better access to those opportunities.
I can only imagine how psychologically damaging it is to watch, peers of yours just be given opportunities when you don't get the same. I mean, I can't imagine that that's just professionally damaging. It must do a real number on your mental health as well.
Well, I spoke to some people who made that very point. There are people who, even years later, are just extremely frustrated about these disparities. And so even though they haven't been fired or demoted in any way, just that recognition alone can really undermine your self-confidence. It can lead to frustration, stress, and anxiety. It can have a really strong effect on people in ways that are maybe not obvious to people who aren't going through it themselves.
Let's talk a little bit about the type of racial discomfort that you call stigma anxiety. You explained a little bit in the first segment. That's basically kind of self-protection at expected discrimination. Can you tell me a little bit about what that can look like and maybe give a few examples of different ways that Black colleagues may attempt to avoid mistreatment at work?
Right, so stigma anxiety arises from the apprehension of discrimination. And the primary impact that it has is just that it's very stressful and it's very exhausting and frustrating to feel that day in and day out, you have to be on the lookout for people who might be mistreating you or treating you unevenly and unequally. And that's a cost that I think is worth considering by itself, because that kind of stress leads to burnout, changes people's aspirations for their careers, changes their attitudes toward their firms. And that's a problem by itself. But even worse, some people, in trying to manage this stress and trying to avoid discrimination, take on certain types of defensive tactics that may spare them some of these problems, but can also undermine their careers in the long run. And one example of this occurs when people choose not to speak up or to speak out in situations where it might be in their best interest to do so. So the classic example is at team meetings, you might have many Black professionals who end up being very reluctant to speak because they're worried that their senior colleagues are going to judge their ideas more harshly than their peers. And that if they make mistakes or they say something that ends up being a silly idea or just obviously incorrect, that that's going to be really, really damaging for them. So instead, they're quiet and they end up getting criticized on their performance reviews for not being more enthusiastic and engaged and not contributing more. So that's one potential way that you see stigma anxiety leading to downstream problems. Another is that it leads people to not share information about their personal lives with their colleagues. And so again, you might think that, well, personal lives are different from work lives, so that shouldn't be a big deal. But because relationships are so important, and sharing personal information is a big way that people form tight relationships with one another, this can really undermine their abilities to form bonds with senior mentors and colleagues.
And you make the point in the book, a lot of Black people are concerned that they're not going to be seen as professional if they share too much or if they swear in the workplace. So it kind of leads them down a road of being more formal and perhaps less open to share anything, detailed or personal about themselves with any of their colleagues at all. And then that comes back to bite them as not being warm and connected.
Absolutely. And that's a real problem because these assessments affect whether people decide that they want to spend time with you. And one person I interviewed mentioned that his boss cursed a lot and some of his white peers cursed a lot, but he was convinced that if he engaged in the same type of conduct, it might rub people the wrong way or they might experience it differently. And so he ends up being sort of the person who's not fitting in and stands out, and people end up not getting as close to him.
And I think we should make the important point that these fears are grounded in reality. This is not just, we can't sit back and say, well, they should just speak up. It's no big deal. Like every idea is welcome because we know for a fact that research shows that white people who make mistakes are given more leeway than Black people who make mistakes. And I have to point out that study of the blind memo. And when we say blind memo, we mean not a memorandum, but like a legal memo that was written and it's identical and it was given to attorneys to judge. And can you kind of explain how they scored it when they thought a white person wrote the memo versus a Black person?
Thank you so much for raising that point because it's an incredibly important one. These aren't just irrational, paranoid people. There's extensive research on this showing that Black people are held to higher standards in many ways, especially if their colleagues have biases. And the memo study that you reference is a great example of that. So a nonprofit organization sent out this memo to people who were partners at a number of different law firms around the country. And one batch of these partners were informed that the memo was written by a young Black attorney, and the other group was told that it was written by a young white attorney. And it's the same memo. And the partners who had been informed that the memo had been written by a young Black attorney found way more, significantly more errors in the memo and gave it a lower overall score than the partners who received the very same memo and had been told that the author was white. So that just suggests that when race is involved, there are senior professionals who are going to be more, who are going to notice mistakes that Black professionals make and maybe judge them more harshly for it.
And I have to just use the numbers because this enraged me, but it was a 3.2 out of 5 was the score the memo was given that was allegedly authored by a Black attorney. 3.2 out of 5, the identical memo written by a white attorney got a 4.1. So that is a significant step up in the scoring when, based on the alleged author's skin color.
Yes.
Sorry, just wanted to put that on the record, ladies and gentlemen. Let's talk about one other concept kind of in this arena that kind of broke my heart when I was reading about it, because I can really imagine how this would go. But a lot of the time, Black employees, you know, whether they're attorneys or investment bankers or consultants, are less willing to ask for help because they're afraid, again, that they're going to be judged more harshly or not taken as seriously. So they are reluctant to ask for help, which means in order to do something that they have to take a lot more time to figure it out themselves or get really creative. And that can lead to problems with an assignment too, whether it's just the amount of time they have to devote to it or whether they don't have as reliable of a sounding board to bounce things off of. So it affects their assignments overall when they don't feel comfortable asking for assistance.
Yes, so this is a real problem for many people. So it's a no-win situation. If you're concerned that your senior colleagues are biased and not going to treat you fairly, you're going to be extra careful about doing anything that would seem to feed into those biases. And so since one important bias is the notion that Black people are less intelligent or less competent, you want to try to do everything in your power not to feed into that stereotype. And so for some people, that involves trying to figure everything out by themselves and not revealing any kind of doubt or uncertainty or confusion. And the problem is that can lead to people taking longer to do their work. And it also increases the chances that they're not going to do it the way the partner wanted them to do it. So they end up, instead of avoiding the negative outcome that they sought to avoid, they actually end up harming themselves anyway by turning in work that doesn't meet the partner's expectations.
There's that one piece of anecdote you include in the book where at a law firm, a Black associate was seated next to a white associate and she could hear people come into that lawyer's office and he would say, "You should have a paralegal do this. I'm overqualified." And she was just aghast at the gall of this kid to be able to say, "No, that work's not important enough for me. Give it to someone else. Give it to someone who doesn't have my degree." And he was turning down assignments and putting them aside. And like just seeing that interaction play out through the eyes of a Black attorney who just did not feel like they had any platform to stand on that was similar to that was really striking to me.
Yes. And she recognized, she said, "Maybe it's because I'm extra aware of the angry Black woman stereotype, but I just can't imagine treating these attorneys the way that my office neighbor does." And that ends up being a big disadvantage in the long run, because she's going to be the one who gets saddled with all of these low quality assignments while he's picking and choosing. So it's a real problem and a real no-win situation if you're in that position.
Are there any upsides to stigma anxiety? Are there benefits to being kind of on the lookout for discrimination and self-protecting?
So I think the benefit would be is if you actually are able to accurately identify which particular colleagues might be especially likely to discriminate against you and to treat you unfairly and excessively harshly. And that could empower you to either avoid those people if possible, but also to maybe be especially meticulous in your work product. And there are some situations where you can do that successfully, and maybe you end up impressing that person despite their biases, and that could end up actually working out just fine. But the problem is that it's really hard to figure out who is actually likely to mistreat you that way. And there are all these other potential downsides that we've just been discussing. Mm-hmm. So it's a very risky situation.
You know, I know this isn't specifically the topic of your research, so I don't expect you to be an expert in this next question, but I do just want to get your take on it. You mentioned just how taxing it is to survive this way in the workplace, because what you're basically describing is hypervigilance, and there's a lot of stress that comes along with being on the lookout for discrimination and trying to avoid it by living your life in a certain way and fitting yourself in a small space. But I have to imagine that it's also very taxing on your physical health. I think about that study that showed that Black women who were treated unfairly by doctors when they were pregnant had actual weathering going on to their bodies. Like, it eroded their physical health to have to kind of deal with their pregnancy with so little faith from their medical professionals. I wonder if being on the lookout for, you know, for stigma. If stigma anxiety erodes people's physical health as well. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think it would have to for the reasons that you explain. I should say my research doesn't allow me to make any conclusions about that because I was only capturing people who are still relatively young. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we didn't really get into the physical health aspects of their lives, other than a couple of people telling me that their physical health diminished because of the hours they felt compelled to work.
Sure, that makes sense. But it seems to go hand in hand that any kind of psychological distress would put a little bit of strain on your body as well.
Definitely.
So we hinted at this in the first segment, and we didn't get into it there, so I'd like to talk about it now. But there is no singular experience to anyone you interviewed for this book. Not every single person had an identical impression of what life was like for a Black professional in these so-called high-status jobs. But we do know that some Black people thrived at large law firms and did really well in investment banking. And what did you learn about that? Why do some Black people thrive?
So some Black people thrive for a variety of different reasons. There are, obviously, there is a role for luck and pure chance to some extent, in the sense that people who get the right assignments at the right times in their careers can in some ways just take off that in ways that other people cannot. And so a couple of people that I interviewed, for example, mentioned really fluke situations where they were able to receive opportunities and assignments by pure chance. And that those assignments ended up being incredibly valuable and helpful for their careers. So that's one thing that doesn't sound very sociological, but it's important to recognize. But it also takes a certain level of ability and consistent, excellent performance year after year. And that's something that, frankly, not everyone is capable of doing. But it also takes being able to form relationships with your white colleagues. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think, to a person, each of the most successful interviewees that I met referenced specific senior white male colleagues who they had ended up forming these close relationships with and who ended up really championing their careers. And part of that is because of what I refer to as white familiarity, mm-hmm. where these people tended to be more comfortable having those interactions with their white partners because they'd had more in-depth exposure to interracial social relationships in the past. So these tended to be people often who grew up in predominantly white communities with white friendship groups, and in some instances had white romantic partners and spouses. And they were just had a level of comfort that allowed them to bridge that gap even more than some other Black professionals could.
Yeah, it's interesting. You made such an interesting point that is so important that even if, you know, Black professional went to a primarily white institution for college, like there are ways that many of them live their lives that doesn't mean lots of integration with white students. You know, you might live in a Black dorm or join a Black sorority or gravitate toward Black student groups. So even if you went to a primarily white college, that's not a guarantee that you're super familiar navigating these very white spaces.
Oh, it certainly is not. And that's one thing that I hope I convey clearly in the book. I chose some of the many examples of my interviewees who shared about their college experiences that they either lived in Black dorms or were just deeply involved and deeply immersed in their college's Black communities. And in a way where they actually afterwards sometimes were marveled at the fact that they hadn't formed any friendships with their white classmates in their 4 years at an Ivy League college. Mm-hmm. And so that's not to say that they're doing anything wrong. There are many reasons why students do that. And there are many ways in which it's beneficial, especially when you're in college. And especially if you're making the transition from another environment where you haven't been around a whole lot of white people. But in these professional settings, it can work to your disadvantage.
And I know you said a lot of the success of Black people in these firms and companies was a little bit random and maybe not sociological, but it seems like the big through line is a white man was kind of key to every single person's success, whether it was, you know, hey, I was in the office early on this one day and I got a plum assignment as a result and I nailed it. So now this white male partner is in, you know, I'm endeared to this person, or we happen to bond over golf at a social event. It seems like a white mentor, and especially a white male mentor, was kind of the through line for everybody's success.
Oh, absolutely. And this is something that these interviewees mentioned immediately. If you talk to people about how they were able to get ahead and who was key to their success, these names would just come out. And I think it goes to show the potential power that individual senior professionals, especially senior white male professionals, have in shaping the careers of their Black colleagues and in helping their firms make progress in these ways.
This may seem like a random placement of this question, but can you explain the up or out career model? Because I'm not sure if everyone in our audience is so familiar with how rare it really is to be promoted to a partner at a law firm or an equity partner. It is not a guarantee by a long shot.
Sure. I think it is helpful if people understand that at these firms, most people who begin their careers there are going to have to leave within a few years. So these firms are based on a model where you have a pyramid structure of sorts, not in the sense of a scam or anything, but
right.
You have a
just
very
the shape.
Small, right. And so you have a very small number of senior professionals who have a very large number of junior professionals working underneath them. And those junior professionals are billing their work out at an hourly rate, and the firm makes a profit on that. But it gets expensive to keep them because as they become more senior, their salaries increase and the billable rates increase. So firms have to let most of them go. And that's what's referred to as the up or out model. There comes a point, and usually multiple points in their careers, where they either are able to advance to the next level or they're expected to leave. So this creates a real time urgency, and it also creates a competition, because there just aren't enough promotion slots available for the number of highly talented, highly qualified workers that work at these firms.
When you put a lot of the research that you've done on top of that reality, this book becomes kind of even more impossible to comprehend to me. I mean, the fact that that's how it's modeled, and then you have so few Black people represented even at the associate level, and then so very few at the top, it's kind of a marvel to me that, you know, any young Black person attempts this.
Well, that's certainly, it is a marvel in the sense that many people choose not to pursue this for that very reason. There are people who just decide that this isn't for them because they won't realistically have a chance. And there was one person I interviewed who said, it can't be that all these people who came before me weren't as good as me. Mm-hmm. And he explains that getting to an institution and seeing that people who look like you never advance just sends a strong signal, creates a very strong assumption that you're not going to be able to advance either. And so some people don't even try. They don't take these jobs, or they take them and then quickly decide that they need to find a backup option because they're not really going to be able to have a long-term career there.
So let's talk a little bit about the end of the book, where you outline things that firms can do to really chip away at this. Obviously, racial discomfort can't be eliminated by a training or, you know, a specific set of rules to follow with assignments, but we can make a difference collectively if we understand some of these systemic problems and try to move away from them. Can you give a few of the little tips that you have towards the end of the book that maybe firms and companies can keep in mind when they're building their programs?
Sure. I think firms and companies, there are a number of approaches they can take that would at least marginally offer some potential progress. Awareness is key. Mm-hmm. I think that firms and companies need to adjust their training practices so that they move even further beyond bias to address and raise awareness about some of these more subtle issues. Just because, and this is something I don't think I mentioned, but it's easy to misinterpret racial discomfort as something else. Mm-hmm. So when Black professionals are going through these problems, it's easy for someone else to misread that and to say, wow, these people just aren't collegial. Or maybe she's not saying anything because she doesn't have anything smart to say. And so that can affect how people are being perceived, and this kind of training could really prevent that and thereby make a difference. I think it also, especially in this legal climate where affirmative action and race-based policies are under increased scrutiny, I think that some of this has to come from individual senior professionals, and firms can encourage them to act on their own behalf. But there really needs to be people taking accountability for reaching out to their junior Black colleagues and making sure that they're not falling through the cracks these ways, making sure that they're getting the opportunities and the support that they need to thrive. And I think there's also an increased importance in addressing perceived discrimination and perceived unfairness, because the thing that stigma anxiety reveals is that these appearances of discrimination have a broad effect. They affect far more Black people than firms might realize because the word spreads. And so if somebody is seems like they're getting a raw deal, that word travels down possibly to dozens of Black professionals, and it makes it that much less likely that they'll expect to be treated fairly as well. So these are just a few things that firms can do differently. They can also be more conscientious about where they hold work at events and work activities and sort of the nature of the small talk in some of these client meetings. These are all things that firms can do better.
I'm guessing constantly soliciting feedback from Black employees can only help. I mean, if you're regular, not just checking in on new employees who are junior and learning, but people who have been there, I mean, I'm assuming having a big open circle of communication can only help.
Yes, I think that I think it's very important. I will say there's a downside if it ends up feeling like we're expecting too much of these individual Black employees, like they have to constantly report to their senior colleagues in ways that their white peers don't. But they should at least have the opportunity to do so. And I think that that would allow firms to possibly nip some of these problems in the bud. And some of these small adjustments could really have a big impact.
I wonder what you've heard from people who have read this. I feel like this is the type of book where people feel really seen when they read some of the stories of the interviewees that you included in this research. Have you gotten a lot of feedback that people really appreciate this, the time you took to really get these stories out on paper?
Yes, and that's actually been the most fulfilling part of doing this research is when I present it to non-academics. Or when people read excerpts of it and contact me and say, thank you for your discussion of this particular problem. So I just got an email a couple of days ago from a man who said that he had been working for 30 years and didn't quite have the terminology to explain what it was that was bothering him about his firm. And he felt that this book really spoke to his experience. And yeah, so he felt seen. I've actually, one of the things that's interesting is that I get a lot of feedback from people who aren't at these elite firms, but who nonetheless still experience this in their industries. So it really applies to a lot of different kind of white collar roles and work settings, from nonprofits to corporations to academia.
I want to ask you, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but I do want to ask you one thing. When you think about the work that you did, the questions you got to ask, the conclusions you got to draw, was there anything you wish you had had more time to explore that you didn't get to include in this that has kind of inspired you to think about new research?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are a number of things I could have done differently. They all would have ended up with me just doing many more interviews. One thing I'll say is most of the people that I interviewed were attorneys. So there was a cross-section of different professions, but attorneys were overrepresented in the sample for various reasons. And I wish that I could have expanded this even further and really focus on the differences between industries and not just the commonalities.
And did anything surprise you? I mean, I assume like any good researcher with kind of a mind for philosophy, like it seems like you have, anybody with a law background is a good philosopher. Is there anything that you didn't expect to find when you started interviewing people that you did?
Yeah, so I think that as a sociologist, I thought that there would be a much stronger and more obvious class effect to the extent that I had a feeling that Black professionals who came from more privileged Black backgrounds would tend to do much better than Black professionals who came from the most disadvantaged backgrounds. And there might be some difference, but it really wasn't as obvious as I expected. And that's because people from all types of backgrounds can still encounter these racial discomfort issues. So that was probably the biggest single surprise.
My guest this hour is Kevin Woodson, sociologist and professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law. His new book is called The Black Ceiling: How Race Still Matters in the Elite Workplace. Kevin, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoy talking about this.
Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.